Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Head Medicine Nurse at the Royal Veterinary College, Nicola Reid. Thank you, Nicola. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to CPD Solutions Chemotherapy in Practice, How Can Nurses Get More Involved? So I'd like to start really going through our talk today. As the human-animal bond is as strong as ever, the treatment of animals with neoplastic disease is becoming much more common in veterinary practice. This opens up a huge range of diversity with our nursing skills, which are utilised to enhance the care of the patient seen by our veterinary team. This webinar aims to give you an overview of many elements of these nursing skills relevant to chemotherapy, and also allow us to reflect on our current circumstances and investigate ways to improve, diversify, or simply learn more on the subject. Now, topics discovered in this one-hour webinar will include ethical considerations of treating animals with cancer, chemotherapy monitoring, quality of life assessments, and client liaison. So really, oncology, what is involved? It's all in the understanding. So the diagnosis, there's obviously differentials, the approach and how the nurses are involved and how to help these patients while they're going through the diagnostic process. It's about the understanding of the prognosis. So it's all about evidence-based mean survival time. So if an animal is diagnosed with a particular neoplasm, how long is it expected for them to live with without treatment? Those treatment modalities depend on the availability as well, whether or not they're traditional treatment modalities or whether or not any of them are novel, so new or in research at the moment. There's comorbidities as well, which may affect some of our patients. A lot of our animals with neoplastic disease are older, so that can exclude some treatment options for them as well. And then therefore, for us to understand all about the planning, so the goals of treatment, experience, client expectations, and relationships with the caregivers, so that's us. The client commitment, so what they want to do, what their expectations are, what financial availability they've got, whether or not the animal's insured, or they're literally paying for ongoing treatment out of their pocket. The impact on the work and the family and the patient behaviour as well is also really, really important to what we do, and understanding how to look after these animals. And of course, measurable quality of life will give us a baseline and goals to be working towards. And essentially what we need to do and what we'll go through today is minimising the adverse events in relation to chemotherapy. So therefore, in the whole, the quality of life is the key goal in chemotherapy treatment. Now, taking a holistic approach, as nurses, we're all taught to appreciate a holistic approach. It's all in the planning. So these ethical considerations, so understanding what is important to the client and their education, so explaining to them what kind of expectations and outcomes that we could be looking at. We need to be thinking about chemotherapy monitoring, how we're going to manage these cases, how we're going to give them their chemotherapy, and how we're going to monitor them afterwards. Look into ways of managing adverse events, so which, as I said, we're going to talk about a little bit later. And we're going to go through some chronic pain and quality of life assessments. And then finally, the end of life care and compassion fatigue, which some of our colleagues may encounter, because of, essentially these animals do have terminal illnesses, and it's about being prepared and making sure that the end of life care is just as important to both the patient and to the client. Now, it's clear that the purpose of having animals in our lives has changed. Companion animals are kept to bond now with human beings. They enrich our lives and give and receive love. Now, Rowling's book on veterinary medical ethics, theory and cases, explains how this change has led to companion animals being treated as an integral part of the family, providing a sense of security, stability and support. Given this changing role of companion animals, people will inevitably hold more value for them. Some pets may serve as the last link to a replaced loved one after death or divorce, or when the children leave the family home. It's also suggested that the human-animal bond becomes more established with age and life experiences, and so therefore can result in the owner challenging their own moral boundaries when faced with subsequent loneliness. Now, given the consistent advances of oncology innovations in the veterinary field and the acceptance of cancer being seen more as a chronic disease, some of these ethical issues faced by the veterinary team are centred on whether we have a moral obligation to the choice of the client or to the patient's needs. Now, this issue is described again by Rowling as the fundamental question of veterinary ethics. This can become apparent in practice where there is a difference of opinion of what is the right treatment of choice for the patient. And some discussions may be had between individuals who are unconvinced of the ethical, moral and professional reasons for a patient's treatment and whether the needs of the owner are being met over the patient's. We have to, however, remember that within our legal system, animals are property and that their treatment is fundamentally left to the individual, or more accurately, the individual's personal ethic, so therefore the owner's ethic, which can lead to the moral challenge for the veterinary team if the owner wishes to accept or decline the advice given. Now, there's two main contrasting theories which describe the ethical reasoning behind an action: consequentialism and deontology. Now, deontology, or occasionally known as social ethics, state that we're morally obliged to act in accordance to a set of principles and rules regardless of an outcome. So when we think about our oncology patients or our veterinary patients, the social ethic values control of an animal's suffering above and beyond than it does the animal's life. So owners that so these are the kind of owners who are not blinded by selfish concerns. Now, consequentialism is based on the consequences of one's act. Therefore, a morally right act should produce a good outcome. So meaning that if a goal is morally important enough, any method of achieving it is acceptable. So using the same example of one of our patients, consequentialism ethic values an animal's life more than it values the control of the suffering. So as long as that animal lives, then it doesn't matter what level of suffering is encountered. Now, client communication, as we know, is an essential skill. It should be key for the veterinary team to understand and manage a client's expectation to promote the quality, which they may that may then extend the quality of the animal quantity, sorry, of the animal's life. It's the veterinary team's responsibility to educate the owner on evidence-based information so that they can make a clear and conscious and essentially informed decision. Now, utilitarianism is a form of consequentialism which calculates the advantages and the disadvantages of that actual act to determine the outcome. Now, this is particularly useful for us as colleagues when deciding the best course of action for a patient. And so, therefore, it's a reasonable assumption that the profession uses this form of moral process to go about our daily work. So if you look at a client that understands and appreciates the position of the veterinary team in treating their pet with oncological disease, considerable time should be taken to explain the fundamental importance of the quality of life, which is the primary goal in treating cancer-bearing patients. And it should be also extended to anybody in practice or within your social network who has similar concerns. Now, the principle of practice which we work within the guidelines of the Royal Veterinary College, the veterinary professionals seek to ensure the health and the welfare of animals committed to their care and fulfil their professional responsibilities by maintaining these five principles of practice. So that's professional competence, so being able to be skilled enough to do the job that they're doing, having honesty and integrity, being independent and impartial, so therefore not being ending up going into a directed conversation based on peer pressure or anything like that, client confidentiality and trust, and obviously professional accountability. So anything which you do, you need to be professionally accountable, and us as registered nurses now understand that's importance. Now, as veterinary professionals seek to ensure the health and the welfare of animals committed to their care, and so therefore alleviating pain and suffering is an integral part of our duty. Quantifying pain has been described quite well by Kitchell and Guinan in 1989 to have a sensory discriminative dimension and motivational dimension. Therefore, it's assumed that animals lack the actual intellectual power to reason out pain, and it's suggested that they perceive pain in the here and now and thus the never ending. So this notion supports the argument that keeping animals comfortable should always be the top moral and professional priority, and that control of suffering and distress should be the primary ethical imperative. It must, however, be appreciated, especially within our field, that in order to control pain, some pain must be accepted to return to normal health. Otherwise, there will be no treatment would be undertaken, for example, with an animal with a broken leg. Now, so why treat animals with cancer, especially with chemotherapy? In people, we know these drugs make humans horrendously sick. They put them at risk of infection and may not even work. Well, we still manage azotemic cats with chronic kidney disease, despite some of the time they look pretty miserable. They're in and out of the vets on fluid therapy. We see as well the arthritic dogs, that despite the best of our ability to try and manage their chronic disease, their discomfort can result in grumpy behavioural changes and sometimes even aggression to their caregivers and owners. And then what about rabbits with severe dental disease who are unable to eat, drink or groom, the main qualities that we associate usually with basic animal rights? Now, cancer treatment will always depend on the tumour type, so bearing in mind the tumour burden and the predicted response. So going back to what we were saying, to understand that in order to control pain or discomfort, no treatment would work if we didn't actually instigate some degree of pain. So therefore, surgery is the treatment of choice for most primary solid tumours, for example, carcinomas and sarcomas. So total excision still remains the best way to achieve a local cure or pain relief. Radiotherapy as well is used in the treatment of malignant tumours, which because of their site or extent cannot necessarily be treated by surgery alone, and therefore the major tumour types and sites treated with dogs include malignant tumours of the mouth and nose, and therefore allowing them to be able to eat and go about their normal qualities. Now, our main focus today is about chemotherapy because it's been become established as the treatment of choice for many of the hematological malignancies, especially lymphoma and forms of leukemia, and diseases which are systemic in their nature, most important those that are sensitive to cytotoxic therapy. Now, multimodal therapies as well are combinations of the different techniques that we've mentioned and others more novel treatments that are coming into our clinical practice. Now, for example, we're going to talk about canine osteosarcoma for a moment. Now, osteosarcoma is the most common bone cancer, which is seen in more than 85% of bone tumours that we identify in dogs. Now, the disease is characterised by a progressive tumour, which is quite aggressive and most often affects the appendicular skeleton in the dogs. Now, the most common sites for metastasis are the regional lymph nodes and lungs. So the majority of patients, which is say 70-80%, do develop life-limiting pulmonary metastasis. Now, management of osteosarcoma is directed at two aspects. One, control of the primary tumour, the main quality of life impacting factor, as you can imagine the discomfort associated with this bone tumour that you can see here. There we go. Around there, protruding from the distal aspect of this patient's limb. And then the second part is addressing the high risk, so greater than 90% chance for systemic disease or spread. I want to introduce you to Ozzy. So he looks pretty happy. So he was in a lot of pain with his osteosarcoma 2 weeks after having his treatment, tumour removed from his distal femur by total limb amputation. He's now back to one of his favourite qualities, which is his space hopper toy, and now he can enjoy it without the pain caused by the primary tumour. Now, an ethical question here is that now what we've done is alleviated this patient's pain in order to increase his mean survival time or disease interval time would be to treat him with chemotherapy. Now, current mean survival time for canine osteosarcoma with amputation alone is only 4 to 6 months. Now, not all patients recover quite so quickly, and especially because osteosarcoma is more commonly seen in a larger breed dog, it could take them a long time to get back up on their feet. Now, with amputation plus chemotherapy, the mean survival time is extended to 9 months to 1 year in about 40% of dogs. And some of these dogs even live longer, and approximately up to 20% of them are still alive 2 years later. So that comes down to the ethical decision and what we've been talking about thus far, of whether or not to instigate any discomfort for this patient to give him chemotherapy, which I hope to convince you of how we manage that in practice as we go through. Now, chemotherapy is used essentially for systemic neoplasia or highly chemosensitive tumours. We don't use it when there's a more effective option, so if there's surgery is better or radiation, for example, or whether or not neoplasms are not sensitive to chemotherapy, which may be on the basis of a low grade or mitotic index. The image on the bottom right of the screen is essentially a cell in the middle of mitosis, so splitting into two. So if you've got a slow division of these cells, chemotherapy isn't going to work so well. Now, chemotherapy is essentially divided into several groups based on the factors of how they work, their chemical structure and their relationship to another drug. And because some of these drugs act in more than one way, they may belong to more than one group. Now, knowing how the drug works is important in predicting side effects, which helps oncologists decide which drugs are likely to work together. And then if more than one drug will be used, this information also helps them plan exactly when each of the drugs should be given and how often. Now, cytotoxic drugs affect the dividing cells, so they can be cell cycle specific or non-specific, and they do have the effect, as we said, on tissues with a high growth fraction or high mitotic index, so dividing factor. But essentially, they really do affect the bone marrow and the gastrointestinal endothelium as well. They cause cell damage in either a cell cycle specific manner or a cell cycle phase of non-specific manner. All tissues throughout the body, both normal and of tumour, contain cells that are actively dividing, as well as cells that are quiescent, so sitting dormant. Now, chemotherapy drugs can damage the DNA and prevent cellular replication and or induce apoptosis, so cell death, and they can work during this specific phase of the cell cycle, such as the mitosis, so the actual splitting, and prevent complication of that process. Now, the problem is, as we said, that if the patient's cells are normal cells are constantly dividing, then it can target some of the normal tissue and cause cell death that way. So what do we do? So chemotherapy is not administered at the same high dose as what it is in human. So there's been developed maximum tolerated doses that have been established through research, and the aim is to essentially reduce adverse events, mainly associated with those that are most common, are the myelosuppression and gastrointestinal toxicity, and any long-term organ damage. Other drug-specific side effects can include anaphylaxis, urinary tract infections, things like that as well. But our main focus is going to be on myelosuppression and GI disease toxicity. Now, chemotherapy has a direct action, as we said, against the cancer cells, in particular those with the high replication rate, and used at the maximum tolerated doses have been defined by research. There are established rest periods between the doses that are needed for each cell to that are affected by chemotherapy, so mainly the bone marrow and the GI tract that need to recover. So I had it explained to me once that cancer is like a virus. It's already a mutate that will mutate and replicate again and again as part of its nature. Now, so what needs to happen is you need to constantly be going at this at the cancer cells in order to make sure that you get on top of their replication. And so as you can see here, we've got spaced. These are pulses, doses of chemotherapy given at these rates. But there needs to be time in between them for the cells to recover. Now, the problem is that if the dose interval between treatments, it needs to allow, as we said, the time for the patient to recover, but not so long for a new, stronger neoplasm to form. Now, as we said before, doses in chemotherapy aren't used as high a rate as what they do with people. So fincristine, for example, a common chemotherapy injectable drug that's used in practice and in referral medicine. So if a dog was given 0.5, which is a standard dose, milligrams per meter squared, versus what a human does, which is 1.4 for the same type of tumour per meter squared, you can see that a patient has a dose reduction of essentially 35% from the 0.5 to the 1.4. Now, doxorubicin is another drug that is used in practice, mainly in referral because of the complications that can be associated with administration. But a dog will receive 30 milligrams per meter squared and a human will receive 60 milligrams per meter squared. So again, a dose reduction of 50%. Therefore, we kind of assume that we're going to have less problems with these patients, which is very, very important. Now, with people, you sit them down and you say to them, you give them a choice. So you've sat down, you have your neoplasia explained to you, you have your estimated mean survival times, things like that, and then you make an elective choice to decide what kind of treatment that you're going to adopt. Now, you can't do that in animals. You can't sit them down and explain to them that you're going to make them really, really sick. And so essentially that's why these maximum tolerated doses here have been established. So what you want to do is ensure that you have a clinical effect on the tumour, but at the same time you reduce the side effects associated with having chemotherapy. Now, as I said, the adverse effects that are associated with chemotherapy mainly are myelosuppression and GI toxicity. They can also include hair loss as well, organ damage, extravasation injury, so an injury of the drug being delivered outside the vein, and we'll touch on that in a little bit. They can become urinary incontinent and some behaviour problems as well. It's quite scary for these animals to be coming every single week into their practice and having harmful things essentially done to them. And so behavioural and anxiety issues can manifest as part of their treatment regime, which we need to be mindful about. Now, understanding adverse events all comes down to which drug. So there's different drugs have a different prevalence and severity of adverse events, AEs. It does depend on the dosage, but as we said before, the maximum tolerated doses have been established, and it's unethical to push the boundaries on those further. There are individual factors as well, so MDR mutation status, which we'll talk about in a second, and if they've got any renal hepatic dysfunction. So if an animal, so like with most drugs, when they're administered to us or to an animal, the body literally disposes of them, they have an effect, and then the body metabolizes them and they're worked out of the body. Now, most of the time this is done either by the kidneys or by the liver, and so if they've got renal disease or hepatic disease, those drugs are going to sit in the system for longer and therefore can have a much more enhanced effect. It does also depend on the animal's clinical condition. So sometimes if they're very ill with their cancer, they can have much more of a reaction to their chemotherapy. And it does also depend on their anatomical location of the disease. There's an image down here of this is a tumour on a small intestine along here. Now, so if an animal, if the treatment of choice was that an animal was not going to have surgery, it was for them to have chemotherapy. As you can imagine and appreciate, that there's quite likely that this tumour extends into the intestines, and so therefore if you then kill off those cancer cells, then you can essentially make a hole, and then there's complications there which can arise from, say, septic peritonitis. So it does very much depend on the anatomical location of disease, on what adverse events could be related to what happens to the animal. Now, I've got a brief table here, which I'd encourage everybody in practice to have. I'm always welcome to share it, which you can contact me via my email address for my work. But we devised this as part of our oncology team, where we've listed out literally every single one. This is only a snippet of what we use. So, for example, I'll pick vincristine, which is quite a familiar drug to use. So how the preparation and what it usually comes, what class of drug it is, what's the indications for use, what's the safe dosage range or maximum tolerated dose for dogs and for cats, because they can be different, and then stability. So we reuse, hold our drugs, we prepare them aseptically using a fast seal system, And then we keep them refrigerated and use them regularly. To be honest, a vial of Incristine wouldn't last us half a day here. But if you, for economic reasons and for the client as well, there are research papers for each of these drugs to show how long that they can be stable for. We also list out here the observations and considerations which can happen to the patient, and any contraindications, how to give the drug, and monitoring considerations, which are great when considering things with regards to nursing clinics or for patients coming back regularly. So as we said, different drugs have different levels of immunosuppression. Down the bottom of this triangle here is L-asparaginase, which is a cytotoxic drug used either as rescue or induction therapy for mainly lymphoma. And it has a very, very minimal effect on the bone marrow. So if you've got a sick patient, it's one of those drugs of choice to use to start off with, depending obviously on their clinical need. Now, right at the top, we've got some of the drugs that we use in practice, which have a much greater impact on the bone marrow, and so therefore we need to be more aware of that and act much more carefully. And then, as we said, individual responses to breed considerations. Now, MDR, or multi-drug resistant 1, is a genetic mutation found in many of the herding breeds, some sight hounds, and many mixed breed dogs, because we're not knowing their heritage. The gene is responsible for production of a protein called P-glycoprotein, and this glycoprotein molecule is a drug transport pump that plays an important role in limiting drug absorption and distribution, particularly to the brain, and enhancing the excretion of elimination of many drugs in the dogs. So essentially, all the drugs that are administered to the animal are then absorbed into all the cells, and this glycoprotein pumps the drug back out to be metabolized by the body and removed via whichever system it's eliminated by. Now, in some dogs, particularly these herding breeds or mixed breeds with the herding breed ancestry, have mutation in this gene that makes them defected in their ability to limit the absorption and then distribution of these of some drugs. Now, these drugs are also slower, dogs are slower to eliminate them from their body, and that as a result they experience an enhanced effect of the chemotherapy, and it's not effectively metabolized. So these patients may end up with a much more significant immunosuppression, GI toxicity, or they may have hypersensitivity reactions or even organ failure. And therefore, suspected breeds can easily be genetically tested prior to administering any known drugs known to cause harm. Now, monitoring for adverse events is mainly focused on bone marrow suppression. Now, I've listed here for you, so erythrocytes, so red cells, their cell life is 70 days for cats and 120 days for dogs. So unless they're killed off, used up, or come to the end of their life, if you give chemotherapy to a patient, they've still got red blood cells up to 120 days rocking around their body doing what they need to. Platelets, on the other hand, they only last about 8 to 12 days, but most importantly, granulocytes only last one day. So essentially, if there's immunosuppression on that bone marrow, then there's the one cell line is going to be the granulocytes, which are going to be affected most most importantly. So therefore, your lymphocytes, monocytes, eosinophils, basophils, but most importantly, your neutrophils. Now, so what is neutropenia? So neutropenia is essentially a lack of neutrophils, and it occurs when the bone marrow is not able to make enough neutrophils. Now, this can be because they've been destroyed at a faster rate than they're being produced, so being used up by the body because there's a high burden infection. But essentially, chemotherapy inhibits the bone marrow from making any more of these white cells or destroys them in the blood or bone marrow and causes a neutropenia. So this is what we see most commonly with any patient receiving chemotherapy, human or animal. Now, neutropenia, I hope you like my metaphor, because this is how it was explained to me once and this is how I explain it to everybody else. If you think of the bone marrow as this tree, so you've got to be quite imaginative. So this is the bone marrow, and on the tree are all these lovely green leaves being made. So what ends up happening, so they come into the end of their wood and they're budding and they're looking lovely and they're there ready to be to release themselves into the environment. Now, once they've reached full maturity, so let's just say the neutrophils, they then go red and then they fall away from the tree into the circulatory system. So this is all of the neutrophils going off to do their really important job of fighting infection. Now, what happens when an animal receives chemotherapy or a human receives chemotherapy? What it does is it kills off the bone marrow, or, well, not kills it off. It sort of like shocks the bone marrow, so to speak. And what it does is all of these neutrophils will just fall. They'll all just come out, regardless of whether or not they're going to have any good, they're any good to be able to help the patient in fighting infection. So, and then what ends up happening is the bone marrow is very, very quickly to recover. So then essentially the neutrophils, the white cells, grow all the way back from the bottom of the tree and then end up replenishing themselves at a certain point. So literally fulfilling themselves back again up to our tree, ready to go again. Hope that makes sense. So the nadir is the most important part of what we're checking for our patient monitoring. So it refers to the point at the time when the chemotherapy drug has had its greatest effect on the circulating counts. So essentially the nadir is what we're measuring when we're expecting the patient to be at this point. So at this point when there's all of the neutrophils or white cells which were ready to go off into the system have all been shocked to be released. Some are going to be of any good, some might not be, and there's no new ones there yet to replenish. So this is at the patient's point of being most vulnerable. Now, for most chemotherapy agents, the neutrophil nadir is about 5 to 7 days post-administration. This is why it's recommended that a complete blood count, or CBC, is repeated at this time, usually 7 days post-treatment. Please note, there are some exceptions to this. So in particular, carboplatin has a nadir of 10 to 14 days. So if you measured the animal's nadir at 7 days and it was still relatively high or within normal limits, and there was another dose of chemotherapy, then there is actually a point where they're going to be delayed and a bit vulnerable later. So therefore, you enhance the effect of what you're doing by adding in another drug. Cisplatin has a doubled nadir, so at 7 and at 17 days as well. It has two low points, and lomustine is less predictable, so it can nadir at any point between 7 days and 21 days as well. Now, this is trying to give you an example of what a nadir looks like. So if an animal received its chemotherapy down here at day zero, then essentially what's happening here is the bone marrow is having so the bone marrow is becoming more and more suppressed by the chemotherapy that's in the animal system. And the neutrophils are being used up by the body as it naturally responds to all of the bacteria that are there usually. So what happens here is where your nadir is of what you'll check, say, for example, with carboplatin at day 12 when it's at its lowest, and then gradually the bone marrow recovers and starts to replenish the circulatory system again. Now, grading of neutropenia is, for most chemotherapy, the neutrophil count at the expected nadir is anywhere between normal and 1.5. At this level, the risk of complicating illness is really low, but because the time of the true nadir is not always known, because it can happen anywhere from the 5 days, prophylactic antibiotics might be started on an outpatient basis. So in animals with a mild grade 1 neutropenia, the dosage of the chemotherapy drugs causing that effect is not normally changed the next time the drug is administered, unless recovery is delayed during the next treatment. For example, the chemotherapy dose is scheduled to be administered 7 days following the last treatment. Now, grade 2 neutropenia, so an animal with a neutrophil count of 1 to 1.5, again, the risk of complicating illness is again fairly low, but prophylactic antibiotics are usually started and continued for a 5 to 7 day course, usually amoxicillin, coamoxiclav, or TMPS on an outpatient basis. These animals, the doses of the drug causing this effect isn't normally changed, but the next time the dose, so the drug is still used, although the veterinarians sometimes prefer to make a dose reduction, say 10 to 20% less what they used the last time for all subsequent doses. However, it's important to remember, like we said before, that any dose reduction necessary for the safety of the patient can ultimately result in a reduction of the intensity of the treatment. Now, grade 3 and 4 neutropenia, some animals experienced a more pronounced immunosuppression, like what we discussed potentially with an MDR mutation, or they just have an individual response. Now, a neutrophil count anywhere between 0.5 and 1 is grade 3 following chemotherapy. And again, at this level, the risk of complication illness is a little higher, although not hugely significant, although as long as they receive prophylactic antibiotics. Now, rarely chemotherapy may result in a neutrophil count of below 0.5, and that's grade 4. At this risk, sepsis is very high, and some animals can become septic even if they're receiving prophylactic antibiotics. Now, clinically well asymptomatic animals should be examined but not hospitalised unless parenteral care is needed, so IV antibiotics. An owner should check the temperature twice a day and contact you promptly if it's if it's above normal more than two occasions. What usually happens with an animal that's been notified as a grade 3 or 4 neutropenia, the dosage of the drug causing that effect is usually reduced by 25% of all subsequent doses of that drug in particular, and a complete blood count is collected at the expected nadir after administrating to reduce the dose of that drug, so you're a little bit more on top of things. Now, we mentioned before about sepsis. So this is usually when a patient is presented, they're febrile, so they've got a high temperature, they seem clinically unwell, and then neutropenic. Now, the focus tends to be on trying to locate their septic focus. So anywhere a patient's septic focus could be is where bacteria normally grow. Now, the most important thing is, so they could grow in their urinary tract, they could have endocarditis, an oral infection, respiratory infection, they may have a wound or an implant which may break down as well. Now, these patients which are septic, so are febrile, that are neutropenic, are an oncological emergency. And as we said, it's important to ensure we locate their septic focus. Now, the main thing is that it's likely that the reason for sepsis is due to translocation of gut flora. So your body's normally got normal, your body normally has gut flora, gut bacteria in the intestines, which the body's natural response is to keep those in check. So if any of those bacteria actually manage to migrate out of the intestine, then they're kept in check by the body's normal immune system. Now, if the immune system is dampened, any of these bacteria work their way through the layers of the intestine, and then they can get into the bloodstream. And then essentially what can end up happening is they have an overwhelming septic burden. Now, it's really important that these patients have antibiotic therapy initiated as soon as possible. And broad-spectrum antibiotics, usually amoxiclav and emrifloxacin, so Baytril, are instigated. Aggressive intravenous fluid therapy is usually required and supportive care appropriate to the individual case. Prognosis with these animals is usually fair to good, and it's really important that as long as they're identified quickly, they're given the antibiotics as required, and they recover quite well. Now, gastrointestinal toxicity. Treating emesis in our patients is really, really important because of the stigma that goes along with chemotherapy. One of the most major complications of chemotherapy is probably the thing that causes the greatest owner concern, and therefore any gastrointestinal toxicity, i.e. nausea, anorexia, vomiting and diarrhea, are possible with many of the agents that we use. And as we said, different animals respond differently. Mainly cisplatin, dacarbazine are the main drugs which cause these problems. And the time of onset does vary, but it's usually the day of infusion for up to about 24 hours, but it can last for weeks. In either case, it's important that nausea or vomiting is controlled early so that the additional complications of anorexia and dehydration doesn't add to the patient's concern and lead to the owner's interpretation of a reduction in quality of life. Now, treating emesis in our patients, it's important to understand the pathogenesis of vomiting, but put simply, vomiting is caused by stimulation of the chemoreceptor trigger zone, the CRTZ, in the postrema of the medulla. Now, this is sensitive to blood-borne substances, for example, chemotherapy. That's why it's quite a nice way to remember it. But it can also begin with different afferent receptors located in visceral organs, so including the gastrointestinal tract, pancreas, liver, peritoneum, and it sends essentially impulses to the vomiting center in the brain and induces the animal to vomit. Now, the standard approach to treating patients in our clinical setting is to pre-medicate patients due to receive known GI toxic chemotherapy drugs with meropenem or Cerenia at 0.5 mg per kg for cats, up to one, and 1 mg per kilogram for dogs. Patients are then sent home usually with 2 to 4 days worth of treatment and given advice on with the owner to treat if necessary. Now, meropenem is a neurokinin receptor NK1 antagonist that blocks the pharmacological action of the neuropeptide substance P in the central nervous system. Now, substance P is found in significant concentrations in the nuclei comprising it in the emetic center and is considered a key neurotransmitter involved in emesis. Now, by inhibiting or stopping the binding of this substance P within the emetic center, meropenem provides a broad spectrum of effectiveness against both neural and humoral causes of vomiting. Now, for cases which have been admitted to the hospital for supportive care, so this is where they're really, really sick post-chemotherapy. They are usually started on IV fluids to correct any losses and then delivered at a rate initiated by the veterinarian. The GI tract is initially rested, so nil per os for up to 12 hours, and then the patient is fed a low-fat single-source protein diet starting 6 hours from the last episode of vomiting. Now, meropenem is usually complemented with, say, metoclopramide if these animals are particularly sick and need to be hospitalised. Now, if metoclopramide doesn't work, so for cases with severe vomiting or those who have had clinical signs that haven't been alleviated with meropenem, may receive ondansetron, for example. Now, this potent HT3 receptor antagonist is proven very well in human medicine to control severe acute vomiting in patients undergoing chemotherapy. Now, ondansetron acts as a selective antagonist for serotonin, which is a principal mediator of this emetic reflex, this sickness reflex, found in the chemoreceptor zone. This principal site of action in the prostrema has also got some peripheral gastric prokinetic activities. So in our experience, ondansetron has produced just dramatic results in controlling or at least significantly decreasing the frequency of vomiting, and doses there are listed. Now, metoclopramide as well can be used. The nice thing about it is it can be delivered as an infusion and tailored as well. So in response to a patient's the effect that it has on a patient. And it's nice for them to go home with as well. Now, diarrhea. Diarrhea is also associated with human medicine as being a major quality of life impacting complication of chemotherapy. Now, again, the prevention is all in the management of it. Now, there is out there a lot of research being done on the role of probiotics to see whether or not that helps. But essentially, what ends up happening is the worry is that if an animal develops diarrhea, that there's going to be more likelihood that as they develop diarrhea, they lose mucosal layers in their intestine, and there's more, so therefore the barrier which protects them from translocation of gut bacteria becomes thinner. Now the reason being, so that what they then do is initiate with metronidazole usually to kill off this gut flora. This usually happens around 3 to 5 days post chemotherapy administration, and certainly some treatments are associated more with the result of diarrhea. So for example, colitis is more common with doxorubicin. Now treatment is diet. So there's a lot of current press on diet, especially raw food diets, which we're kind of still sitting a little bit on the fence with here at the Royal Veterinary College. Some clinicians say, well, that's fine, it's a historical thing, animals have been having raw food for a long time, but others that are having commercial diets, which are essentially almost sterilised in their cans, are less likely to end up with this risk of sepsis if there's less bacteria in it. We treat them just with a normal cooked bland diet, and then administer metronidazole as required, and then antispasmodics if needed, if diarrhea is particularly ongoing. And then we consider a dose decrease or discontinue the chemotherapy treatment if these animals develop such a significant diarrhea. Other reasons bearing in mind is that, as I said, there's a lot of research out there now, and there's a lot of cancer diets in the press. So clients are more leaning towards changing diets for their animals for the better, arguably. But the thing is that they also spoil them, because now that they know that they're not particularly well, therefore they'll give them things, anything really. We have one own client who's amazing and brings the dog a Happy Meal every single time he's had his chemotherapy, which is very interesting. Other reasons could be parasites. So don't forget your basic investigation of why an animal may have diarrhea and just resort it to the fact that it can have it's because it's due to chemotherapy. So there can be bacterial infections, protozoal, parasitic infections. But some chemotherapy also gives animal pancreatitis, and so that does need to be bear in mind as an investigative process. Now, other chemotherapy-induced side effects can include anaphylaxis. So we can appreciate here that this dog has swollen up on the left-hand side of his face. That's post L-asparaginase infusion. This poor cat's lost his whiskers. And this is because it does happen with poodles as well. They do go a little bit bald. It's because animals have one long guard hair, which comes from their follicle. And like with people, it's an ongoing growing hair. And then so with people, they lose their hair from that one hair follicle. But animals, also bearing in mind, they have downy hair that comes out of the same follicle. So owners will often report that their pet's got a sort of like a softness now to their coat. And once they've been clipped after having investigative procedures or diagnostics, their coat grows back really, really soft and fluffy. That cats in particular with prolonged chemotherapy do lose their whiskers. Doxorubicin does have an accumulative effect on the heart and can cause dilated cardiomyopathy and fatigue of the myocardium. And cyclophosphamide can cause hemorrhagic cystitis as well. So all of these other things, it's about knowing your drugs. And that's why we developed that list, which I showed you earlier, of all the different complications. Now, going on to safety and handling of cytotoxic drugs, we know that cytotoxic drugs interfere with cell growth and division, and therefore can be carcinogenic, mutagenic, tetragenic, and so therefore need to be handled with care. So especially pregnant women shouldn't handle cytotoxic drugs. Drugs or body fluids from patients receiving chemotherapy should be handled as cytotoxic, and therefore you should investigate different systems of work and invest in certain protective precautions, which we're going to go through. Now, how can we be exposed to cytotoxic drugs? So an accidental contact with a known agent, so get it in your skin, your eye during administration, ingestion, inhalation, or accidental to injection. Now, unprotected handling of tablets, so capsules or unlabeled agents, is also an important thing to consider. Never should we be splitting cytotoxic drugs unless using a fume cabinet, and that's why they're enteric coated as well. So the idea is that they're It allows for the tablet to be administered, goes down the into the digestive tract, and therefore that's when it's dissolved. Now, evidence-based and why we need to be careful, it comes all the way back from the 1970s. So the University of Helsinki reported that traces of chemotherapy agents were found in the urine of oncology nurses. In 1980, nurses reported that they were experiencing side effects similar to those of chemotherapy patients, including nausea, vomiting, hair loss and mouth sores. Now, in 1990, there were wipe studies found that contamination appeared in approximately 75% of samples taken from working areas. That's not necessarily from where chemotherapy was prepared or administered, but from even workstations. Now, studies continue to find hazardous drug contamination throughout the pharmacy and nursing settings and in the urine of oncology staff in human medicine, and include those not directly involved in the preparation process or the administration process. So we're talking like porters and auxiliary nurses who are assisting with these chemotherapy patients, which then essentially comes down to the fact that there's got to be a degree of contamination. So we need to work as safely as possible. Now, listed here is many of the chemotherapy drugs that are used commonly in practice. And again, we've done a nice list to list out all of the different types that they have, but most essentially the IARC category. So this limit lists out how significantly dangerous these drugs are. Now, most of them are at sort of like a 2 or a 3, but the most important one is cyclophosphamide, and that's the one to remember. So not a lot of practices use it as an injectable form, but that's why it's really important, because cyclophosphamide is used so commonly in general practice, of why these are the drugs to be careful with and certainly shouldn't be being split. Now, administering cytotoxic agents, many of you who know about administering chemotherapy appreciate that we need a suitable environment, suitable attire, equipment, disposable waste and patient safety techniques. So I'm literally going to run through these slides just so that you can understand that the significance of them, but and then you can refer to them again if needed. Now, the suitable environment makes sure that you've got a designated area, an adequate ventilation source, and contains all the necessary equipment. If you think about the contamination likelihood, which has been discovered in research studies, you want to make sure that everything is there, so you're not having to go back and forth through the practice trying to get the things you need. Now, protective clothing, you should always be wearing gloves. Now, there's special chemo safe ones, or double glove them if they're not available. However, they're now supplied mainly in the UK. We used to have to ship ours over from the US, but make sure they're these chemo safe ones, and you'll see on the box down here that they are listed as chemo safe. Make sure that you wear a long sleeve water resistant gown, and ideally one which literally extends all the way to the sleeve cuffs, or get ones that you put through your thumb loop and then put your gloves over them. And if you're not using a closed system, you should be wearing a face mask and goggles too. Extra items in the working area. So if you're going to be working with chemotherapy, you should always ensure that there's a spill kit available. So if for whatever reason that the drug becomes loose in the environment, it's spilt, comes out of the syringe, or patient's wiggling about and everything becomes disconnected, then you have a spill kit, which I'll show you an image in shortly. Extravasation kit is also an important and integral part of what you do when you're administering chemotherapy, and having standard operating procedures associated with what you want to do and what you're going to do should there be a delivery of the drug outside the vein. There should always be an emergency contact, so people should know what you're doing. So always working with a colleague at all times, and agree a method that if something goes wrong, how you're going to contact somebody. I put the minion on here because I love the bit in Despicable Me where they literally come banging through the door like Beedo, Beedo, all over the place because they just don't know what's going on. So when administering chemotherapy IV, make sure that you've got a decent administration kit, so get everything all together. You've got an absorbent pad to be working over, and importantly, you're using Luer-Lock syringes. So these are the syringes that put together and they screw on. We put it together as a catheter kit with a good adhesive tape. Post-treatment dressing as well, so that you can identify the patient that it's had chemotherapy, and get your therapeutic agent ready, so it's all there to be done all at once. It's nice if you put everything in a containment bag, and then you've got your disposal system ready next to the area that you're working. So again, use everything that you do for your patient, put it back in a containment bag, which we just use one of the great big see-through plastic lab bags, nothing fancy, and then it goes into our cytotoxic waste. Just a silly slide here of the anatomy of a nurse, because we know that we are extremely well worked and extremely well paid, and so therefore we should be always aiming to make sure that you've always got another nurse to help you out, and therefore we can also become more and more involved as well, and ask your clinician when you're doing your chemotherapy if there's certain elements which you can be delegated. Now, there's always desirable equipment. We always want to improve what we do. It's nice to have a dedicated room, a specific administration system, ready to use drugs. So there are providers from human hospitals or human pharmacists that will get your drug ready to be delivered. Syringe pumps and syringe drivers, depending on the drug that you're using and how long it's going to be administered for. But the biggest investment would be a designated safety cabinet, but these cost a huge amount of money. So it's all about reflecting on what you do and what you have, and working the best as what you can in the environment and the resources that you've got. Now, I just wanted to put in here about phlebotomy considerations in the chemotherapy patient. A lot of us just reach for the cephalic or the saphenous vein, and there's a lot of discussion about whether we should start low in the limb and gradually work our way up the leg. Now, there are also other options, so using the medial saphenous vein, the metacarpal and the metatarsal. So literally the back of the, if you look at the back of your hand, those vessels there are really quite large and are great for using alternate areas should a patient, you have difficulty catheterizing a patient. It's a nice image here of a cat, which where you can appreciate the different areas. Now you can see here, so we always aim for the cephalic. Up here you can see roughly the dimension of that vein, but coming down here you can see just how thick it is as well. So quite often you can use these veins, the metacarpal and the metatarsal veins, to administer chemotherapy. They are a little bit uncomfortable, so we recommend that you clip them and emla them, and then you should find it easy to be able to catheterize with a little practice. And again, in a dog as well. So again, you can appreciate the size of these vessels distally in the limbs to be able to administer drugs here. Intravenous chemotherapy. So it's really important that you ensure that there's good restraint and the patient is comfortable. You always want to make sure that you use a first stick secure catheter. So the catheter has to go straight in the vein. So you're always using a forward motion. You don't come back, redirect or anything like that. It goes straight in. If for whatever reason you need to come back and redirect, consider the type of drug that you're using. A lot of them are vesicants, so it causes irritation and an extravasation injury if the drug's delivered outside the vein. And especially in this image where we're using doxorubicin, it can cause a huge amount of tissue damage, and some patients have unfortunately have had to have limb amputations because of it. Always fluff your catheter before and after with just normal saline. We don't use heparinized saline anymore, and heparin does precipitate in the presence of some drugs as well, so just normal saline is fine. As I said before, always work over an absorbent pad and always observe the vein. So any bolus, any time you inject in, make sure that you can visualize around that vessel and have a look to see that it's going in and there's no bubble forming. Always, whilst everyone's very focused on making sure that they deliver their drug very safely and very effectively, but some of these patients can have immediate side effects as well. So nausea, anaphylaxis, and cardiotoxicity. So the responsibility of the restrainer or the handler is to just to be talking to the animal, making sure that everything's okay, they're not licking their lips, they're not gagging, checking their mucous membranes, things like that are all really important. And then obviously afterwards you want to flush your catheter, take it out and dispose of all your needles and syringes into cytotoxic waste. So what about subcutaneous injections? Because there are some drugs, for example, cytarabine, gemcitabine, bleomycin and L-asparaginase, which are administered subcutaneously. And there's no way that you can administer them via a closed system. And so they just have to be given like a normal subcutaneous injection. So we recommend that you clip the area, so make a small square so that you can see that the needle actually enters into their skin. After injection, wipe the area with your glove and then examine the glove to see if there's any wetness there at all, which will identify whether or not there's been any leakage. And consider a dressing, especially if the patient goes home with a particularly young family or someone who's pregnant, to make sure that there's no risk of contamination there. When you're withdrawing your drug, put the needle into the bottle encompassed by some normal gauze swabs as well. And this is obviously where a fume cabinet has a major advantage. Tablets and capsules, we said as well already, not to crush them or break them. Drugs can be reformulated if necessary using specialist compounding pharmacies or labs. We use Nova Pharmacy. Wear gloves at all times to administer and dispense in a labelled childproof container. Remember to cut blister packs into strips, so don't pop the drugs out and put them. So if you've got drugs that are in a blister pack, certainly don't put them in a normal cardboard dispensing box, and don't pop them out so that they go into your click top container. The idea is that you should cut them into individual capsules or pills and then put them in their blister packs into the container. We mentioned before about spillage. So it's great, there's marketable spill kits available. You need to, if there is a spill, restrict access to the area. So regardless of what's going on, you need to clear the room, make sure that there's a lot of ventilation in the area. These spill kits always come with instructions, absorbent pads, protective clothing, shoe covers, and those kind of things. And it's important to have some form of standard operating procedure. So a do this, do this, do that, so that you know which procedure to follow should there always be an accident. If you get all these things ready and in line, then hopefully the likelihood of it happening will be minimal, but it will contain any problem should it occur. If you have an incident reporting system, then it's significantly advantageous to report it and then investigate what happened. For example, if the syringe has come disconnected from the needle or the administration system, looking at it and reviewing what you do can always help prevent an accident in the future. So this is how we've converted to absolutely all lower lock syringes, even for our flushings as well, because they do come disconnected. It's all about reflecting. And promoting the best practice, so that's why you're here today as well, is to focus on safety, about how to prepare your drugs properly, how to administer them better, monitor the patient for any adverse events, make sure that when drugs are being calculated that there's safety mechanisms for ensuring that there's no overdose. We use the Farseal equipment, which is great as well for practice use. It's a closed locking system for drawing up and administering chemotherapy, and it's sold by BD syringes. And they've got a really nice website which you can refer to, with a whole host of information which you can present to your colleagues to help convince them of why it's important to use. So just final thing here about patient safety when we come to administering. We always want to make sure that we're using the safe doses ranges, so you'll find those in the formulary, and that you're checking your nadir prior to administering chemotherapy. The form here on the right shows how there's double check calculations. You're checking against the last dose and you're checking your right patient. So here you would list out absolutely everything in which the animal's having done, their weight, and then their weight is usually converted into meter squared before times in their dose, and then you that's equal. So it's a bit like, you know, when you were at school and you were always told to do your working out, then you can see if there's any error. So you complete the whole form, or the clinician completes the form, and then the initials go on here. And then essentially what we do again is that form is just handed to somebody. You don't go through it with anybody, you literally hand it to the next person, who checks everything from the beginning, and then they double check and put their initials in here. What we also do is we list out their previous treatment to as a comparison. So if last time they had 1 mL of vincristine and this time your calculation shows 1.2, it should flag up why is that. And sometimes it comes down to dosing for lean body weight or the animal's lost a significant amount of weight, but it's worth checking against one and the other. And then check in to make sure that their complete blood count's been done. So check in the nadir to make sure that they're then okay for chemotherapy. Then always noting where you've put the drug, batch numbers, if there's any sort of like problems further down the line, and also who administered it. So just a quick summary of chemotherapy administration. So the use of an IV catheter must be IV stick, first stick, flushing with saline before and after your treatment, minimise the trauma to your peripheral vein, so alternate them. Always make sure you've got good restraint. You shouldn't be doing anything by yourself, and dilute the drug if needed, particularly with ones that cause extravasation injuries. Check the patency through the entire administration. So draw back, so check for a blood flush to see whether or not you're still in the vein, and observe it the entire time. And be prepared for adverse events, so a spill kit and an extravasation kit. In our extravasation kit, it also includes things for anaphylaxis as well, because that's a possibility. The image you have here on the right is actually an extravasation injury. So where this is vincristine, which is sort of like middle of the road with regards to injuries for drugs which are delivered outside the vein. And you can see here how it's leaked around the catheter, how swollen and sore it is as well. The good news is that most of these patients will revert back to normal with some good wound management. Suitable disposal of waste. So designated cytotoxic bins, any clinical waste should be double bagged, and it should be labelled and recorded as well, because it needs to be removed by a licensed carrier. So if you're doing chemotherapy in practice or dealing with animals that have had chemotherapy, then there should be identifiable waste boxes and bags, so that the carrier knows that they're dealing with a different type of waste. The same goes for waste from hospitalised animals. We put a nice little sign on the front to say that they've received cytotoxic drugs and wear the appropriate PPE when handling. Inform all of the kennel staff as well. So those include the any volunteers, any visitors, any students as well. So they should all be doing the same thing and being careful with what they're handling. There is on the ECVIM website, they do have guidelines for risk periods. So because you're always supposed to be making sure that you ensure that you're double bagging any of your waste, that there's a designated toilet in area if at all possible, because there are small traces of these drugs present in the body for a prolonged period of time. Now, the ECVIM do list out what cytotoxic drugs are commonly used and how long the risk period is afterwards. And so something like that in practice is very, very useful to those who are managing these kind of cases, and also for the owners at home. Client information with regards to chemotherapy administration. So discuss with them prior to administering any chemotherapy how they're going to manage the animal at home. Inform them of the hazards of administrating these drugs and understand that complications are a risk. It's supposed to be on the consent form that things can go wrong. Clients need to be educated on the safe handling of the animal's waste and be committed to the safe handling of when the pet is at home, and exercised alike as well. So just because they're keeping their garden clean or a designated toileting area doesn't mean they're okay to be just off the lead on the park and not clearing up. And introducing client leaflets are the most significant help with getting client understanding as well, and going through it and building rapport as well. Record keeping. So as part of health and safety documents, you need to be making sure that you've got operating procedures, control of substances hazardous to health should all be listed, material safety data sheet, so what to do if with regards to any personal exposure, and also a list on staff training as well to show, remember going back to the RCVS 5 points in which to show competency. Now, just to round today up, we just want to go. I just want to go over a couple of bits with regards to recognising pain in oncology patients. Pain is now considered to be the fourth vital sign after temperature, pulse, and respiration, the fifth vital sign in humans after blood pressure, and should be integrated into any patient evaluation that a veterinarian can recognise, assess, prevent, and treat. Now, although traditionally pain has been categorized into acute and chronic pain based on duration, the more contemporary approach is to consider pain as either adaptive or maladaptive. Now, adaptive pain is a normal response to tissue damage. Adaptive pain includes the inflammatory pain, which is a major component of pain states, including acute pain occurring with surgery or trauma. Inflammatory pain can also be included in chronic pain states such as osteoarthritis and cancer. The ability to recognise and adequately assess pain in the veterinary cancer patient is essential in the management of the disease. Now, pet owners are increasingly concerned with how much pain their pet may be experiencing, and in humans, at least half of the patients with malignant cancer experience pain, and two-thirds have pain severe enough to interfere with their sleep, mood, and social interactions. Now, pain in the cancer patient occurs from the tumour, say for example, compressing or infiltrating into surrounding tissues from skin, nerve and other changes caused by hormone imbalance or immune response. Now, the presence of pain often depends on the type, location and stage of the cancer, as well as pain tolerance of the individual. Treatments such as surgery, radiation and or chemotherapy may also cause pain of what we've discussed today, but most chronic pain in the cancer patient is caused by the cancer itself. And whereas acute pain is more often caused by treatment of, and diagnostic, so interventional. Now, recognising and assessing chronic pain in our patients can be difficult. In non-verbal patients, for example, obviously animals, the assessment of pain relies on the observations of the caregiver that knows the patient well. Now, measurement of objective physiologic parameters, so temperature, pulse, heart rate, etc., has proven to be unreliable as indicators of pain because of the influence of non-pain parameters such as stress, distress, anxiety, normal biologic variation. Now, an observer's perception of pain is often related to behavioural changes in an individual animal, and well-being of animals is usually associated with normal specific species behaviour. Changes in behaviour, as we can see here with dogs and cats, may be a sign of pain. And so here we've got listed the different types of pain signals which can be seen with animals in chronic pain. Now, quality of life assessments in unison with recognised pain scores. There are several scoring tools that have been used in animals. However, to date, there is no single acceptable pain scale that has been developed for the dogs and cats. A single scoring system for both dogs and cats is not possible because of the species-specific behaviours associated with pain. Now, scoring pain in non-verbal patients is such a particular challenge, and so therefore we need to distinguish between the varying levels of pain and intensity, and the importance of pain to the animal. The most validated and widespread pain scale used in veterinary medicine is the short form of the Glasgow Composite Pain Scale, which was designed to measure acute pain only, and such is unsuitable for the use of chronic painful conditions such as cancer. Now, more recently, a novel system was published by the University of Pennsylvania, where they published a pain assessment tool called the Canine Brief Pain Inventory, so the Canine BPI, which is based on the human brief pain inventory in a canine model of spontaneous bone cancer, so very relevant to our subject. Their research concluded that the canine BPI reliably measured the same pain that constructs in the canine model as does in people, and it performed very well in various tests of validity. Additionally, the severity and interference of scores correlated well with the quality of life question, that such as if pain scores have an impact on the animals of life and perceived quality of life decreasing. There is now emerging tools here. There's currently two published questionnaires that attempt to address health-related quality of life in veterinary cancer patients. Lynch and colleagues from the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies developed a cancer treatment form that consists of 23 multiple choice questions divided into domains entitled happiness, mental status, pain, appetite, hygiene, etc., etc. And it's proved as a real good prototype instrument in measuring health-related quality of life, and has not yet, though, been assessed for validity, reliability, and responsiveness. And there's another one listed here from colleagues at Michigan University who have developed a quality of life survey for the use in cancer chemotherapy setting. Again, this instrument has been limited with dogs and is undergoing validity. So essentially, client communication is the key to as a resource when assessing chronic pain in our patients. Owners may need prompting and close questioning to report changes in their pet's behaviours, as they may not associate these changes with chronic pain. There is evidence base for behaviours that alter in association with chronic pain, and these should be the basis of exploration with the owners. Now, changes in pet's behaviour may be subtle and take place gradually, and therefore the team need to ensure that when questioning the owner, they prompt the owners to reflect over a period of time or months. It's particularly useful to identify behaviours from the owner that can be used as markers to help determine a response to treatment. So, for example, he really likes to play with his tennis ball, but since he's been diagnosed, he hasn't been very well. But since having his second round of chemotherapy, he's now wanting to play with his ball when he's at the door wagging his tail. Things like that are helpful markers. So I hope from the talk today you can see how oncology nurse clinics can be such a valuable resource in oncology patient care. And so I want to finish on a couple of slides just on bereavement as end-of-life care, which is going to be one of the most significant memories in an owner's journey with their pet. Preparing for the end-of-life decisions is always about understanding the disease process. So having the ability to liaise with a client in terms which they understand what to expect from this type of neoplasm that their pet unfortunately has been diagnosed with. It will help also understand and monitor for manifestation of the original signs. So if a dog was lame, for example, when he was first presented, been having chemotherapy and now is no longer lame, then great. But if he starts to become lame on his leg again, it's something to raise. Understand the client's expectations. So going back to what their ethics are, understanding what they want to get out of this. You need to also manage their expectations because their animal is not going to live forever. But allow them to understand what to expect is going to happen as the disease progresses. Revisit the treatment goals. So right in the beginning, when there was an agreement made between the caregivers and the client of what wanted to happen, the treatment goal is always to alleviate pain and ensure quality of life, and remind them of that as needed. By doing all of this, you should hopefully be able to establish a trusting relationship and just constantly remind and discuss the patient's qualities. So going back to that tennis ball, if he hasn't touched his tennis ball for the past week, 2 weeks, then remind them how important it was to that animal. Research suggests that for many people, the grief of experiencing after the loss of a pet is analogous to the grief experienced to the loss of an important human companion, such as a parent, child or spouse, so just as important. An owner may feel, or a person may feel, anger, despair, social isolation, rumination, depersonalization, loss of control, death, anxiety have also been identified. All of these things, as much as 26 weeks post-loss, and some symptoms can persist for up to a year. Now, there are ways to support the client by trying to normalise the experience, explaining that this is a normal process for what's happened, how they're feeling. Educate them on the human-animal bond, the grief process, and about reactions. Positive coping mechanisms to manage grief can also be finding ways in which to share memories and discuss how when things were great and how he enjoyed that trip to the beach and things like that will hopefully essentially get to a point where they can find peace and learn to reinvest in life, learn to maybe have another pet. It's not the first thing that's on their mind, but they need to find the peace before they can reinvest and go back to normality and enjoying life again. We can do that by enhancing our training and experience, but there are also specialist websites and professionals for some of the clients who are finding it particularly difficult. And don't forget about us. So there are possibilities that sometimes we can get to a point, especially in clinics when they're having a bad week, and there is a known syndrome called compassion fatigue, which is known as secondary traumatic stress, which is a condition characterized by a gradual lessening of compassion over time. It's a common amongst individuals that work directly with trauma victims, such as therapists, nurses, psychologists, police officers, first responders, animal welfare groups, etc., etc. And it was first diagnosed in nurses in the 1950s, where sufferers exhibited several symptoms, including like hopelessness, a decrease in experience of pleasure, constant stress and anxiety, sleeplessness or nightmares, and just generally a negative attitude. This can have a massively detrimental effect on not just the individual, but also the team, professionally and personally, including a decrease in productivity, the ability to focus, and development of new feelings of incompetency and self-doubt, that whole what's the point feeling. Now, coping for compassion fatigue is something which we all need to take on as individuals. You need to find your own method for reducing the impact on you. Go out, leave work at home. It's a good thing to be able to reflect, but sometimes people get it out of their system. They go for a run, they go for a jog, they meet friends. But do remember that you to understand what the team is achieving is always a positive intervention. If you're focusing on quality of life, alleviating pain and doing a good job with the resources that you have, then you're only going to be able to do good. Because if you're extending the quality of an animal's life, then sometimes with that comes quantity. But it's always a good thing to remember that this is what it's all about. And then finally, it allows us to remember to grow in the diversity of a skill set and change mindsets. So yes, there are some times where we do have bad days or things don't go very well. Our patients in oncology are terminal, mostly. Not all of them are able to have curative intent surgeries and things like that. But we grow in the diversity of our experiences, and therefore we can change mindsets within the profession and in with the community as professionals. So to round up this our talk, which is a little bit longer than expected, oncology nursing is all about the things listed here: caring, compassion, the communication, the client bond, doing one's best, spending time, having empathy, understanding, etc., and etc., all the way through there. But essentially, the most important thing is focusing on an animal's quality of life. For us as oncology nurses in practice, we can essentially do more, envelop more, and do things with our professional development. We can continue our CPD and self-directed learning on the subject. We can challenge ourselves with our phlebotomy skills and practical skills and get more involved. It doesn't have to be something that the vet does. We can explore bereavement training as well, which will have multiple uses throughout, not just on our oncology patients. We can review all the practice standards which we've touched on today, look at our administration techniques, our spill kits, extravasation, standard operating procedures, make sure that we're adhering to the appropriate waste management, review and use extra tools like some of the ones I've shown you today, just so that more people are more aware of the drugs that they're using. And where possible, if you've got a good patient load of oncology cases which you see, you can introduce nurse clinics. So you could be the ones administering the chemotherapy, monitoring them for the nadir, making phone calls on follow-ups, making sure that animals aren't nauseous with their chemotherapy, assisting with their restaging, so x-rays, ultrasound, CT for those of you that have it, and focus on addressing chemotherapy associated side effects and liaise with your clinicians and get on top of making sure that these animals aren't nauseous. If they have any diarrhea, that is dealt with quickly. Introduce quality of life questionnaires. I think this is a main scope for many of us, ourselves included, and client information leaflets as well. So all of these things are ways in which we can get more and more involved. Does anybody have any questions? A couple of them have popped up. Some people have been having problems getting hold of Serenia, and what do we use instead is what I've been asked. So metoclopramide and ondansetron are very, very clearly good in using instead. Obviously, we use Serenia because it's part of the cascade and it's our first port of call. So it's what we use and we have to use it first. But at this present time, we can't get hold of Serenia. So we use ondansetron. It's very educating to read the patient inflammation leaflet that you get in generic ondansetron, which explains about a specific phenomenon where humans will walk into a chemotherapy hospital or treatment center and they feel sick already because they psychologically remember how ill it makes them as they have their drugs administered. I have witnessed this in some of our patients, usually the clever Labradors, the really well trained ones who come in and they know what's going to happen to them. So it's really important to try and make sure that these animals are palliated and pre-medicated with antiemetics prior to having their chemotherapy. And personally, I find ondansetron the most significant impact on quality of life for these animals. But obviously, it's very clear that it's a clinical decision which your vets need to make. But with regards to Serenia, in this current climate where for I think it's a manufacturing problem, we should you could try ondansetron. Another one that I've got here is what quality of life assessment tool do we use or I use? I think that's a really interesting question. We don't have a tool that we are using at the moment because there isn't anything specifically validated to work for all of our patients. We have got a research project going on as we work in a university. And so what we have at the moment is a nurse checklist. So it's simply a checklist of all the different things which when liaising with a client for an oncology nurse appointment, it includes questions which are related also to their clinical assessment. For example, is Fred weeing okay? And if they're like, yeah, he's weeing all right, you investigate that little bit more and you say, oh, is he getting out to urinate? And it's often when you ask that specific question, they turn around and say, no, or yes, he is, but he's waking me up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And therefore, you can then turn around and sort of say, oh, is he upset? And like when he messes in the house, or how are you coping? And I think that's a really important thing. We focus so much on the quality of life for our animals, but it is also about the client as well. We've had clients who, until they're actually asked or prompted, they turn around and say, oh, my cat hates me now. I'm having to run around the sofa every evening trying to give him his medication. That's not a quality in what we're focusing on. And there are normally other treatment options. So, yeah, it's all about communication. So that's my two questions. So thank you very much for listening, everybody. Goodbye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Nicola for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.